touched her lipsticked lips to Franny's ear while whispering to her. Everything these people did was intimate, even the delivery of messages.
"Phone call,"
she said, her voice slipping beneath the din. Franny had never gotten a phone call at the bar. Kelly got them all the time from her ex-husband and her babysitter and her mother, who sometimes watched the baby. The child was never able to make it through the entire shift without facing some unresolvable need. Franny did a quick scan in her mind of all the people who might be dead, then realized there was no guessing. The room was so loud. Competing voices, the eternal clink of glasses, Luther Vandross on the goddamn tape, which meant that Bing Crosby was coming next. Heinrich held the phone straight out to his side, as if it were some nasty bit of carrion scraped up off the road, while continuing his conversation with a customer. He kept his chin down slightly, his shorthand for disapproval. He didn't need to say it. She put a hand over one ear, as if that could actually block out the noise.
"It's Leo Posen," the voice said.
"Really?" she said. It's not what she would have said had she taken a moment to think about it. She had reread First City since escorting him to his bed, and that had kept him very present in her mind. Franny doubted he would have remembered any aspect of that evening, and even if he had, it would never have occurred to her that she would hear from him again. Thinking that Leo Posen might call her required a level of self-aggrandizement that Franny Keating did not possess.
"I should have called sooner."
"Why?" she said.
"I put you in a bind. I never checked to see if you got in any trouble."
"Oh, no trouble," she said. She looked out over the bar and imagined they were his characters drinking there. Septimus Porter himself holding a highball glass, his girls making all a racket.
"I didn't hear you."
"I said it was no trouble. It's really noisy in here. It's happy hour." Heinrich was staring at her, and she put her hand over the receiver.
"Leon Posen," she said to him.
But he only shook his head and turned away.
"Could you come to Iowa City on Friday?"
"Iowa?"
"There's a party I have to go to, and I thought you might like it."
He stopped for a minute, and Franny strained to hear any noise from where he was calling, but the bar was too loud. She pressed the receiver even harder against her poor ear. Finally, he started to speak again.
"Actually, that's not true. I don't think you'd like it, but I thought I might be able to stand it if you came. I'd get you a room at the hotel. It's not the Palmer House, but it would be okay for the night."
"I don't have a car," Franny said.
"I'll send you a bus ticket. That's even better. You never know about the weather out here. I'd worry about you if you were driving. Would you mind taking the bus? I could send the ticket to you in care of the hotel. Franny at the Palmer House Bar. What's your last name?"
From across the room, she could see a man at one of her tables holding up a glass, tilting it side to side. It should never come to that, customers having to beg for a drink.
"Keating, listen, I have to run,"
she said, her eyes fixed on that one glass, how the ice caught the light above the heads of the crowd.
"I'm going to lose my job again. I can take a bus."
Franny was on the schedule, but there was never any problem getting someone to take a Friday. That's where the money was. And as soon as she had given the night away, she felt the loss of it. Even if she wasn't paying for her ticket or her room, the trip was going to cost her.
"He wants to sleep with you," Kamar said when she told him about the phone call.
He was still up when she came home from work, sitting at the table amid piles of books and post-its. He seemed the slightest bit dejected, even though he had to expedite a review of an article that was 100 pages long with over 100 footnotes. He didn't have the energy to think about Franny, much less sleep with her. Kumar was right, of course. Why else would anyone import a cocktail waitress from another state? But somehow, that wasn't what it felt like. Leo Posen had waited 2 weeks before he called her, which meant what? That he tried to forget her and couldn't? That the cocktail waitresses in Iowa weren't putting out?
"Maybe he likes my mind," she said,
and laughed at her own cheerful stupidity. My charming company. He gave her a small, conciliatory shrug, but said nothing. She had woken Kumar up the night she met Leo Posen and told him the story, just like she knew she would. It was nearly 2 o'clock in the morning when she'd climbed into his bed in the dark room and shaken his shoulder. Guess who I met? You have to guess. Kumar loved those books. They had talked about them not long after they'd met. He'd been looking at her bookshelves when she went into the kitchen to make a pot of coffee, and when she returned with the cups, he was holding her copy of Septimus Porter. He left the Updike on the shelves, the Bellow and the Roth. You read Leon Posen? He said, just to make sure they hadn't been left behind by some old boyfriend. Franny and Kumar had met not long after coming to the University of Chicago. They sat beside each other in torts and decided to study together. They had become friends without realizing that soon there would be no time for friendship. Now that Franny was broke and sleeping on his couch, it was hard to say what bothered him most about her trip to Iowa. That a woman he would have liked quite a bit had there been time was going to a party in another state with another man? Or that he wished he were going with her? Or that he wished he were going instead of her? Leo Posen was waiting for her in the bus station in Iowa City. He was wearing his black top coat and a gray felt hat, studying the bus schedule that was mounted under plexiglass on the wall, as if he might be thinking about going somewhere himself. When he saw Franny coming towards him, he smiled a smile much larger and more grateful than any he had given her at the bar.
I didn't think this would actually work, he said, showing her for just a second the sweet, awkward overlap of his lower teeth.
He held out his hand to shake her hand. She would remember to tell this to Kumar, because if the plan was to sleep with her, if that was his sole intention, he would have kissed her right off. It was an easy trip, she said.
You don't understand, he said with great cheer. I thought I was going to sit here freezing my ass off and watch every person get off the bus from Chicago and that none of those people would be you. I might even have come back to check the next bus from Chicago to see if maybe I'd gotten the time wrong. After that, I was going to feel like an idiot. Tell myself how ridiculous it was to think I could send a bus ticket to a stranger and expect that she would get off the bus just because I wanted her to. I had it all planned out. In fact, I was so sure that you weren't coming, I had thought about not even coming to the station just to show you.
That would have been awful, Franny said, because she realized now she didn't have his phone number or his address. He shook his head.
I was going to feel terrible and foolish and old for the rest of the day, and then I was going to call the department chair and tell him that, given the circumstances, I couldn't possibly come to his party.
Well, Franny said, not quite understanding any of it, I guess I ruined your plans.
Oh, you did, you did. You shot the entire day.
He rubbed his hands together to warm them, and then sank them deep into his pockets. It was a nicer bus station than she expected to see. The floors were swept, and there was no one sleeping on the benches in the waiting area, but it was nearly as cold inside as it was outside, the deepest cold of the wind-swept Midwestern prairie in late February. The one ticket agent in the window wore a hat and gloves, along with his heavy coat.
"Do you want to go to your hotel first, freshen up, take a rest?"
Franny shook her head. "Not particularly." It didn't make any sense that he should be so surprised. Of course Franny Keating would visit Leo Posen. The question, then, she supposed, was to what extent did he see himself as Leon Posen? If he saw himself as a famous novelist, then he would have known she would be there. But if he saw himself as someone she had met in the bar, well, he was right. She would never have gotten on a bus for anyone she'd met in a bar. Not for a single other circumstance that she could think of. She wouldn't have taken anyone else to his room, either. In fact, the thought of it gave her a chill that was in no way connected to the freezing bus station. Still, when she looked at him, she didn't feel that familiar sensation of having made a real mistake. She only saw Leo, and was glad to be in Iowa. He took the canvas bag off her shoulder, the one she'd used to carry her school books in back in her school days. It had always been so heavy. Now there was just a nightgown and toothbrush, a change of clothes for tomorrow, the volume of Alice Munro stories she'd been reading on the bus.
"It doesn't seem like you're planning to stay," he said.
"Just the night."
"Well, then, I should show you a little bit of Iowa before it gets any darker."
"I saw an awful lot of it on the bus coming in. It looks like Illinois, the parts that aren't Chicago." The ride had taken 5.5 hours. In between the Munro stories, she'd watched all of those endless snowy fields poked through with 100,000 broken stalks of corn, and the long shadows those stubbled cornstalks threw across the snow in the late afternoon light. She'd leaned her head against the window, field after field after field, and not an inch of space wasted on something as decorative and meaningless as a tree.
"You've already figured it out, then," he said, and pointed to the big double doors that led out to the parking lot. "I'll take you to dinner instead."
Together they stepped into frozen air, the soft sweep of snow just beginning to cover the recently shoveled walks. Old snow was layered over the ground, the parked cars that hadn't been disturbed, the tough little shrubs that would bear the snow's impossible weight until spring. She could feel her own brittleness as the frozen air did battle with her coat. It was no worse than Chicago. It might even have been 2 degrees warmer. And still, it was like walking into a wall of broken glass. She pictured those early settlers in their covered wagons crossing the prairies in search of a better life. Why did they stop here? Were the horses lame? Was it springtime? Were they so hungry that they brought their wagons to a halt and said, "This is far enough"? "Tell me again why this is better than Los Angeles," Franny asked. She wished she could put her arm through his arm and lean into him. He was tall enough to block the wind.
"I'm not married to anyone in Iowa."
"Let's hope that's true for most of the states."
"That's what I like about you. You have a positive take."
He put his hand flat on her back and steered her into an Italian restaurant, which looked like it might have recently been a diner.
"I'm overestimating," Leo said, looking at his watch. "There probably isn't time for dinner. There's probably only time for a drink." "Can you manage with just a drink for now? There'll be plenty of food later on."
Franny was just glad to step out of the weather. The wind blew in the door behind them, making an arctic puff across the tables and causing the other diners to look up. The restaurant, unlike the bus station, had a zealous heater. "I'll manage fine." She started to zip herself out of her coat and unwrap her scarf, pull off her hat. She wore boots with rubber soles and rubber covering over the toes. They were lined with the pelts of cast-off teddy bears. There was no vanity in winter. The bartender was a woman who could have been on either side of 60, with a swept-up pile of blonde curls nested on the top of her head, and a black vest which nearly failed at its job of containing her bust. The name Ray was stitched across the left breast in looping cursive.
"There he is," Ray said. "Ducking in before you have to go to work?" "I thought I should," Leo said. "I tried to get off," she said to Franny, her eyes bright inside their spiky cages of dried mascara. "But I couldn't do it. What are you going to have, darling?"
"The same," Franny said, tilting her head to Leo. "And maybe some breadsticks and a glass of water?"
"That's good thinking,"
the woman said, taking a bottle of scotch from the shelf behind her.
"That soaks it up. Are you going to introduce him?"
"Have you not met?" Franny asked, confused. It seemed the barmaid had mistaken her for someone else. She held out her hand to the man beside her. "Do you know Leo Posen?" This pleased them both to no end, Leo and the bartender, and they both gave a nice big laugh that brightened up their end of the bar in this dismal little restaurant.
"Ray,"
she said, and held out her hand to Leo, who took it in both of his hands for a shake. Hail fellow, well met.
"She makes me ice," he said. "I keep it in a Ziploc bag."
Ray reached into the freezer beneath the bar and pulled out the bag on which she had written, "No touch," with a heavy black marker.
"He thinks that Iowa is trying to poison him with bad ice."
"He told me," Franny said, nodding.
"I told you that?"
Leo asked, taking off his scarf and helping himself out of his coat. He was wearing a suit again, this one dark blue, and a regimental tie. "Who am I supposed to introduce you to?"
"You introduce him to the audience at the reading tonight," Bray said, and used a highball glass to scoop up two servings of the ice. "Big deal famous writers hardly mean anything in this town, but I like to go when I've got a free night. I've been going for years. That way I get to see all my customers while they work. And you know what all of them tell me? They say, 'Ray, you should be the one writing books.'"
Leo nodded his head in sincere agreement.
"You should."
Ray smiled at him and then turned her attention back to Franny.
"Sometimes they have one of the kids in the program introduce the old men. Speaking of, I should get a look at your ID.
Franny rummaged around in her purse for her wallet and then handed her driver's license to the bartender, who took a pair of readers out of her pants pocket and actually looked at it, which was more than Franny ever did. Franny almost never carded anyone, and when she did, she figured that someone handing you identification was tantamount to being of age. When Ray was satisfied, she handed both the glasses and the license to Leo.
"Look at this," she said. "Francis is almost 25. Honest to God, I would have thought you were 17. That's the thing about getting older. Everybody else starts looking younger."
Leo took the glasses and looked for himself.
"The Commonwealth of Virginia," he said,
and turned the license over, maybe wondering if she had chosen to donate her organs.
"I thought you were from Los Angeles."
"I am, but I learned to drive in Virginia."
"So, if she isn't your student and she doesn't know you're supposed to start reading in 20 minutes, who is she?"
Her tone was still jolly, but Ray was looking only at Leo now, and Leo continued to look at the driver's license.
"She's my bartender," he said in distraction, and then remembered himself. He looked up at Ray and smiled. "My other bartender."
Franny didn't correct him. The woman behind the bar did not wish to hear another word from her. Ray poured Dewar's in two glasses and pushed them forward.
"That's 8, she said.
The breadsticks and water were not her problem. A crowd was starting to form at the warm end of the bar, farthest away from the door, and she went to attend to them. Leo Posen put a $10 bill on the bar. If he understood what had just happened with his friend, who made him ice at home and brought it to work in a baggie, he gave no indication. He was paying attention to his drink.
"I have to give a reading, and then there's a party for me afterwards. It's one of the obligations. There aren't many of them, and they're all written down in my contract. I don't have to go to any of the other parties."
"Were you going to tell me about the reading?" Leo gave his head a small shake.
"The way I was figuring it, I didn't think I'd have to in the first place. I didn't think you'd really come from Chicago on a bus. And if you did come, then you'd be tired and want to rest in your hotel room. I'm always tired when I come to a new place. Travel makes me tired, newness makes me tired, and I never go anywhere on a bus. So I was thinking that if you came, you'd need to go straight to bed. Clearly you have more resources than I do."
"Even if you managed to ditch me at the hotel while you read and picked me up afterwards for the party, wouldn't you think that someone might say, 'Didn't you enjoy the reading?'" If she had never met him, she would have come. Had she known that Leon Posen was giving a reading in Iowa City, she would have come by herself on the bus. Kumar would have shirked his responsibilities as editor of the Law Review, something he'd never done, for the chance to go with her. That was the thing Leo Posen didn't understand.
"Or they would say, 'My God, what an interminable reading. And by the way, I wouldn't be ditching you, I would be sparing you. The impulse was polite.'"
Franny smiled, and Leo Posen looked at his watch, then he stretched his neck in Ray's direction. She was laughing with her new customers at the other end of the bar, the broad beam of her back squarely towards them.
You're a professional. What's the best trick you know for getting your bartender back when you're in a rush?
Take them to your reading as your date, Franny said. It works every time. He tapped the face of his watch as if questioning the news.
It's just that it would be so helpful to have one more before we go.
Franny slid her glass over to him. The ice, so thoughtfully made, was just beginning to melt, softening the dewars with water bottled from an ancient spring in France. I don't actually drink, she said. This is a trick I figured out a long time ago. It makes people like me. Leo looked at the glass, and then he looked at Franny.
My God, he said. You're a magician.
Chapter 5. An unfamiliar bicycle was parked in the hallway outside her apartment, where people were not supposed to park their bikes. But of course, that did nothing to tip her off. Jeanette opened the door, the grocery bags cutting into her wrists, her coat and boots made heavy and hot by the four flights of stairs. And she found her brother sitting on the couch with her son in his lap.
Look! Look! Her husband said.
In his excitement, Fode hugged her before thinking to free her from the plastic bags. Bintu, their babysitter, rushed to wrestle the bags from her other arm and then helped her out of her coat. They treated her like this, the two of them, like she was the queen of Williamsburg.
Albie?
There was no question that this was her brother, but it was the difference between seeing a boy and a man. Albie's hair, which had been a sweet mess of dark curls, was now a thick braid, long enough to make Jeanette wonder if he'd cut it even once since she'd seen him last. And where had the cheekbones come from? There were rumors of the Mataponai tribe slivered into the DNA on their mother's side. Maybe the Mataponai had risen again in the youngest cousin's child? He looked like he was playing the part. My wild Indian, Teresa used to say when he would run through the house screaming. Now here he was, as thin and as quiet as a knife.
Surprise, Albie said, the word a flat statement of fact. I am surprised to be in your living room. You are surprised that I'm here. Then he added the thing that had been most surprising to him. You have a baby.
Deo, the baby, was holding onto the rope of Albie's hair. He gave his mother an enormous smile, both to say he was glad she had come back to him and also he was very pleased with their exotic guest.
Scarf,
Bintu said, and unwound the damp wool from Jeanette's neck. She plucked the hat from her head and shook off the melted snow. It was February. Jeanette turned to her husband.
This is my brother,
she said, as if he were the one who had just walked through the door. It felt almost accidental seeing Albie in her living room, the way some other long-lost siblings might run into one another in an airport, at a funeral.
I saw him on the street, Fode said. He was walking a bicycle away from our building just as I was coming home from work.
Albie nodded to confirm the implausible story.
He came running after me. I thought he was some crazy guy.
New York, Bintu said. The good news washed over Fode, pouring from him, the thrill of it still so fresh.
Except I was calling your name, Albie, Albie. The crazy guys don't know your name.
Jeanette wanted nothing but to step into the hallway for 5 minutes and pull her thoughts together. The room was too cramped. Albie and Deo sat on the couch like guests while she and Fode and Bintu remained standing. Had they just now come in the door, or had they been waiting for her for a while? How much of their discussion had she missed?
You were just walking down the street? She said to Albie. My street? Of all the streets in the world?
I was coming to see you, he said. I rang the bell. He shrugged, as if to say that was it, he'd tried.
But he rang the wrong bell, Bintu said. It didn't ring here.
Then Jeanette turned to her husband. None of this made sense. So how did you know it was my brother?
There were no pictures of Albie in their apartment, and certainly Fode had never met him. Jeanette tried to think of the last time she'd seen her brother. He was getting on a bus in Los Angeles. He was 18. Years and years and years.
Fode laughed. Even Bintu covered her mouth with her hand. Look at yourself, he said.
She looked at her brother instead. He was an exaggeration of her. Taller, thinner, darker. She wouldn't have said they were too much alike, except when compared to the West Africans in the living room. Funny to think of someone in the apartment looking like her when Deo looked like no one but his father and babysitter. When Bintu met her at the door at night, Deo bound to her chest ingeniously with yards of bright yellow cloth, Jeanette couldn't help but think, really? This is my son?
Do we look that much alike? She asked her brother,
but Albie didn't answer. He was trying to unlace the tiny fingers from his hair.
I wanted to wait and see you so happy, Bintu said, squeezing Jeanette's arm. Now I'll go, family time.
She leaned over the baby and kissed the top of his head repeatedly.
Tomorrow, little man.
Then she said something else in Susu, a few swooping words of birdsong meant to connect him to Conakry and the motherland.
I'll walk her, Fode said. Then you'll have time.
He had to leave them. He could not possibly contain his good cheer another minute, his elation in the face of visiting family. He put on Jeanette's coat and hat and scarf because they were there, because Fode had very little sense of what was his and what was hers.
Goodbye, goodbye, he said,
waving and then waving again, as if he would be walking Bintu back to Guinea. There was pageantry in the smallest of Fode's departures.
Explain this, Albie said once the door was closed, the two sets of footsteps receding down the stairs,
the animated elegance of French drifting behind them. Fode and Bintu spoke French when they were alone.
They're a couple?
Jeanette hated to admit it, but it was better once they'd gone, just having the extra space in the cramped room, the extra air.
Fode is my husband.
And he has two wives?
Bintu's our babysitter. They're both from Guinea. They both live in Brooklyn. It doesn't make them a couple.
You believe that?
Jeanette did believe that.
You don't need to look for ways to make me crazy. Just seeing you is enough.
Does Mom know where you are?
He ignored her. So this one's really yours.
He held out his arms as far as his braid would allow and waggled Deo back and forth while the baby laughed and pumped his legs up and down.
Can't you just imagine what those old cousinses would have to say about this? They'd make you give him to Ernestine.
Ernestine's dead, Jeanette said. It was the diabetes. First her foot, then she was blind. Her grandmother had tallied Ernestine's losses in her annual Christmas letter until finally the news came of the housekeeper's death. Jeanette hadn't thought about Ernestine much since then, and then the clear picture of Ernestine's face so suddenly returned, she could see her own disloyalty. Ernestine had been the only person in her grandparents' house Jeanette had ever liked. Albie sat with this information for a minute.
Anybody else?
Other people had died, of course they had, but she couldn't think of any people who were Albie's people. She shook her head. The baby began to stuff her brother's braid in his mouth, and so she took him, not sure that Albie would want the baby's saliva in his hair, not sure she wanted that hair in the baby's mouth. She offered Deo her wrist, and immediately he began to work it over with his sore gums, his few teeth cutting against her skin. He turned his eyes up to stare into her eyes as he sucked and chewed. There was something about this gnawing that settled her, brought her back to herself, to this room, this moment.
If you were gonna have an African baby, couldn't you at least have named him something a little less African?
Jeanette brushed her fingers along the plush density of her son's hair.
To tell you the truth, I named him Calvin. But it turns out I could never bring myself to call him that. For a long time, we just called him the baby. Fode was the one who started calling him Deo.
Albie's spine straightened involuntarily.
Then he leaned down to look into the baby's eyes.
Cal?
Where have you been? Jeanette said.
California. It was time to go.
California, all this time? Albie gave a small smile at such an impossible thought, and in that smile she saw something of the brother she had known.
Not even close, he said.
The sleeves of his black sweater were pushed up towards his elbows, showing off the patterned bands of black tattoos that circled his wrists in wide bracelets. Everything was black. The tattoos, the sweater, the jeans, his work boots. Jeanette wondered if he had coal around his eyes or if his lashes were just very dark.
So, do you live here now?
That wasn't the question, but then there was no single question.
I don't know.
He reached out and touched his finger to Deo's chin, making the baby laugh again.
We'll see how it goes.
Then she saw the duffel bag in front of the couch, inches away from the toe of her winter boots. She had somehow overlooked it by looking so intently at him.
Albie shrugged, as if none of it had been his idea. Your husband said I could sleep on the couch until I find a place.
It would have to be the couch, unless it was the coffee table, or the single armchair where Fode studied, or their tiny kitchen table. The baby slept with them in the bedroom in a bassinet wedged in between the bed and the wall. If she had to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, she worked herself out of the blankets and crawled off the foot of the bed. Jeanette sat down on the couch, and the baby, who was just starting to crawl, stretched his arms away from her in an effort to get to the floor. She put him down.
It's not like I'll ever be here, Albie said.
It was the closest he could come to an apology, and it startled her, because even though they didn't have the room, or the time, or the money to keep him, even though she did not forgive him for disappearing for the last 8 years with only the occasional postcard to let them know he wasn't dead, the thought of his going made her want to get up and lock the door. How many nights must he have needed a place to go, but never called her or Holly or their mother? If he was with her now, it meant that something had changed. The baby had hold of the zipper on the duffel and was trying to figure it out.
You'll be here, she said.
Albie and Jeanette were not from Virginia. They had both been born in California. And in that sense, the two of them had been a team, albeit a team neither one of them wanted to be on. Jeanette had applied for her first passport when she was 26, after she had gotten pregnant, after she and Fode were married. He wanted to take her to Guinea to meet his family. The question that made her stop as she filled out the forms in the post office was place of birth. What she wanted to write was, not Virginia. Not Virginia was where she was from. Cal had tortured Albie and Jeanette with the lesser state of their birth.
Take a good look around, Cal had said once when they were driving to Arlington from Dulles,
the passing landscape a multidimensional shade of green never witnessed in Southern California.
They only let you in now because you're little. Dad got permission. Once you're older, they'll stop you in the airport and put you back on the plane.
Cal,
their stepmother said, just his name. She was driving, and she didn't want to get into it, but she flashed her big Jackie Onassis sunglasses in the rearview mirror to show him she meant business.
They'll send you back, too, he said to her, his face turned to the window,
sooner or later. After Cal died, there was never any mention of Jeanette and Holly and Albie going back to Virginia. Every now and then, their father would fly out to Los Angeles and take them to SeaWorld and Knott's Berry Farm. Take them to that restaurant in West Hollywood where girls swam in the giant fish tank along the wall while you ate your dinner. But the endless unsupervised summers of the Commonwealth were over. Albie, of course, moved back later for a single disastrous school year after the fire. And Holly went back for 2 nights as an adult in an attempt to measure just how much peace and forgiveness she had mastered through the Dharma. But Jeanette wrote off both the state and its residents, including, but not limited to, her father, both sets of grandparents, her uncles and aunts, a handful of first cousins, her stepmother, and her two stepsisters. Goodbye to all of that. she hunkered down with what she considered to be her real family. Teresa, Holly, and Albie. The three people who were with her in the house in Torrance when she brushed her teeth at night. It was a funny thing, but up until that point she hadn't fully understood the extent to which her father was gone. That he had left them years ago and would never come back, unless it was to spend the day at an amusement park. Her mother slept alone in her room like Albie slept alone in his. Jeanette, thank God, had Holly. She would lie in her bed at night, watching Holly breathe, and make a promise to herself to hate Albie less. Even if he was simultaneously irritating and unknowable, he was also her brother, and she was down to just the one. But those were lean years for emotional charity, and no matter how many nights Jeanette tightened down on her resolve to be kinder, kindness failed. Without her father, without Cal, the four remaining members of the Southern California Cousinses became more profoundly themselves, as if whatever social ability each had achieved in his or her life had been wiped away in the time it took a bee to sting a boy. The speed at which their mother ran from work to school to the grocery store to home had doubled. She was always arriving, always leaving, never there. She couldn't find her purse, her car keys, she couldn't make dinner. Holly found a box of canceled checks in the desk drawer in the living room and practiced her mother's signature, Teresa Cousins, Teresa Cousins, Teresa Cousins, until she could do it with exactly the right amount of pressure, the pen angled perfectly against the paper. Holly's hard work at the art of forgery meant they could still go on field trips and turn their report cards back in. Holly, who believed in credit where credit was due, took her good work straight to her mother, and Teresa put Holly in charge of paying the bills without ever telling her if it was punishment or reward. Teresa's inabilities in household accounting were legendary, going back to the time when she and Bert were happily married. Before Holly took over the checkbook, third notices and disconnection warnings arrived in the mailbox and were promptly misplaced, so that once or twice a year the house snapped into darkness. The electricity wasn't such a loss if you didn't count the television. And candles flickering in the middle of the table while they ate cereal for dinner made them think of the very rich and the very much in love. But when the toilets stopped flushing and the showers went dry, well, that was intolerable. Everyone agreed the water bill had to be paid on time. Holly, who at almost 14 was good at pretty much everything, was good at math. She started balancing the checkbook the way she'd been taught in home economics, a class that had also enabled her to do emergency mending and make inventive casserole suppers. When she was able to identify the disaster that was their financial state, she taped a rudimentary budget to the refrigerator every week, just like her teacher, Mrs. Shepherd, had told the girls they would need to do later on in their married lives. The last line Holly wrote in red magic marker. This is what we have to spend. Even Albie paid attention to that. For her part, Jeanette dragged the kitchen stepladder out to the backyard and pulled the low-hanging oranges off the trees, then carried them back to the kitchen in a bucket to make juice with the old metal juicer. It was a lot of work, but she did it because orange juice was the way it used to be in their family. At night, their mother took the pitcher out of the refrigerator and made herself a screwdriver. She never asked which one of them had been so thoughtful as to make orange juice, and Jeanette, unlike her sister, couldn't bring herself to say. Their mother was still capable of responding to a situation. Had she spilled the pitcher of juice, she would have mopped it up. But she exhibited zero curiosity. She never wondered about anything except Cal. For the most part, she didn't talk about Cal, but there were little things that gave her away. Like the fact that they used to get stacks of Tombstone frozen pizzas from the grocery store, and now their mother visibly flinched if they so much as walked by them in the freezer aisle. Was it because Cal had eaten so many Tombstone pizzas with sausage and pepperoni? Or was it really just the name she couldn't stand? Not discussed. Now they called for delivery, and the pizzas came to the door. But then one night, when they were all eating pizza and watching television, their mother came right out and said what was always on her mind.
Tell me about Cal.
They had been watching an old Jacques Cousteau program. It had nothing to do with anything.
What about him?
Holly asked. They really didn't know what she meant. It had been more than 6 months since he'd died.
What happened that day?
Teresa said, and then added, in case they didn't understand what she was talking about.
At your grandparents' house.
Had no one ever told her? Hadn't their father explained things? It wasn't fair that everything fell to Holly, but it did. Jeanette kept her eyes on her plate. And Albie. Well, Albie didn't know the story either. That was when Holly was grateful to Caroline for having given her a script to follow. Otherwise, she wouldn't have known what to say. She told her mother the girls had left the house after Cal because Franny decided she wanted to go back and change into long pants because of the ticks, and how there were two ways you could go to the barn from the cousins' kitchen door. How Cal and the girls had taken different routes because they found him when they were coming back. Her mother knew the cousins' house, of course. She and Bert had been married on the front porch and danced in front of 200 guests beneath a tent on the lawn. There was still a cream-colored leather album of wedding pictures in the hall closet. Their father was handsome. Their mother, freckled and pale, with her tiny waist and dark hair, had been like a bride in a fairy story. A child bride.
Why would you wait for her to change her pants?
Their mother asked.
Why wouldn't her sister have waited with her?
Caroline did wait, Holly said. We all did. The girls stayed together. She told her they saw him lying in the grass, and how at first they thought he was playing a joke. The other girls ran back to the house, but Franny stayed with Cal just in case.
Just in case what?
Teresa didn't like the fact that it was Franny who stayed. It was hard for Holly to say the words because they came from a time in her life when she still believed in the possibility of a different outcome.
In case he woke up, she said.
I saw it, Albie said, still looking at the television screen.
It was a commercial, a pretty woman spreading peanut butter onto a slice of bread.
You didn't see anything, Holly said.
Albie hadn't been with the girls, and he hadn't been with Cal, either. Albie had been asleep. On this point, everyone was clear.
I left before you got there. I saw everything that happened before you came.
Albie?
Their mother said. Her voice was sympathetic because she thought she understood the way he felt. She, too, had been shut out of the story.
You were asleep, Holly said.
Albie spun around and threw his fork at his sister, threw it like a javelin in hopes of piercing her chest, but it bounced off her shoulder without incident. Albie was 10, and his gestures tended to be sloppy.
He got shot, and I'm the only one who saw it.
Albie, stop that,
their mother said. She pushed her hands through her hair. She was regretting having asked them. The children could see that.
It's fine,
Holly said. Cool and dismissive in a way that made Albie's head burst into flames.
It was Ned from the barn, he screamed. He shot Cal with Dad's gun, the one from the car, the gun that Caroline got out of the car. I saw it, and you didn't see it, because I was the one who was there. They didn't even know I was there.
Jeanette and Holly were both crying then. Their mother was crying. Albie was screaming that he hated them, and that they were liars. That was how it ended. On that worst of all August days in Virginia, Caroline had already decided to become a lawyer, and so she told the other girls, Holly and Franny and Jeanette, exactly what had happened, even though they'd been right there. This was after they had run fast as horses to the house, and Ernestine had called the ambulance, after they had taken Ernestine back to Cal. Ernestine, 50 pounds too heavy and in ill-fitting shoes, was running with the girls through the back field while Mrs. Cousins waited at the house to direct the ambulance. Somewhere in all of that, Caroline had worked out the story in her head. When did she find time? Well, they were all still running? Once they were back in the house? Cal was in the ambulance, speeding away with the light spinning and the siren wailing for no reason. Oh, but he would have loved it, though. And the Cousinses were in their car, following Cal's ambulance to the hospital. Ernestine was trying to find Albie, who somehow, in all the confusion, was missing. Their father was running through the parking lot of his law office in Arlington to jump in his car and race to Charlottesville to see his son for the last time. No one knew where Beverly was. That was when Caroline rounded the three other girls into the upstairs hall bathroom of the cousins' house, pushed them in, and locked the door behind them. Only Franny was crying, presumably because she had spent those extra 15 minutes with Cal while the other girls had to run to the house and then run back again. Franny alone understood that Cal was dead. Even the people from the ambulance wouldn't say the word dead when all they had to do was look at him. Caroline told her sister to shut up. "Listen to me," Caroline said, as if they didn't always listen to Caroline. She was 14 that summer. Her voice was sharp, rushed. Flecks of cut grass were stuck to her legs and tennis shoes. "We weren't with him. Do you understand me? Cal went to the barn by himself. We came up later, and we found him in the grass right where he was. And when we found him, we ran straight back to the house to tell. That's all we know. When anyone asks us, that's what we say."
"Why do we have to lie?"
Franny said. What was there to lie about when they weren't supposed to lie anyway? Weren't the facts of the day bad enough without compounding them? Caroline, with the full force of her frustration at both the circumstances and Franny's stupidity, slapped her sister hard across the face. Franny hadn't seen it coming, hadn't braced herself, and the blow spun her sideways and knocked her head into the door of the linen closet. The knot on her left temple began to inflate before their eyes. It would be one more thing to explain. Caroline was irritated by the crack her sister's head had made against the door when she was working to keep them quiet. She turned back to Holly and Jeanette, the more reliable two.
"We can be as upset as we want. They'll expect us to be upset. But we're upset because we found him. We are upset because it happened. That's all. Not because we were there."
At that moment, she could have told them that their only way out was to grow tails and swing through the trees, and they would have done it. Caroline was thinking of their culpability, and maybe, because she was Caroline, how it might affect her own college admission. She would be in high school in the fall.
"Tell me again what happened,"
Teresa said one evening to Jeanette. By this point, it had been well over a year since Cal died. As a rule, the people in her family didn't ask Jeanette anything. Holly was studying at a friend's house down the street, and Albie was riding his bike with the pack of boys he had recently assembled. Jeanette and her mother were for the moment alone together, even though they were pretty much never alone. Her mother said it so casually, like it was just another thing she'd forgotten. "Where's my lipstick? Who was that on the phone?" Jeanette could still see Caroline in the bathroom, hear the barking clarity of her directions. She could see how sweat had dampened Caroline's hair at the temples and soaked through the collar of her yellow t-shirt. But she couldn't see Cal anymore. In just a year, his face had slipped away from her.
"I wasn't there," Jeanette said.
"But you were there," her mother said, as if Jeanette had forgotten. "If you want to find the person who did it, you have to ask the same questions over and over again," Franny had told Jeanette one summer when they were in Virginia. It was years ago, before Cal died. It was one of the police skills Franny was trying to teach her, along with breaking into cars and taking apart the phone receiver so that you could listen in on other people's calls without their knowing. "Sooner or later, someone always slips up," Franny had said. Jeanette wondered if her mother was trying to slip her up.
"He got tired of waiting for us," she said. "He was going to go see the horses, and we were going to catch up."
"You caught up," her mother said. Jeanette shrugged, an awful gesture given the circumstances, disrespectful. It was too late. It was after Cal died that her mother finally lost her freckles, as if even they had abandoned her. Jeanette was looking at the bridge of her mother's nose, trying to stay focused, trying to remember what she had looked like before all this happened,
So who gave the pills to Albie? Their mother asked.
Cal, Jeanette said, surprised by how good it felt to tell the truth about something.
He always did that.
With all that had happened that day, no one cared that Albie was missing except Ernestine. After checking in the attic and the cellar, she said he must have gone with Beverly. No one knew where Beverly was. She'd taken one of their grandparents' cars and hadn't told anyone she was leaving. If she'd gone into town, she must have taken Albie with her. If it had been any other day, the very thought of Beverly taking Albie with her anywhere, would have cracked the girls up.
The goddamn boys on bikes is what the neighbors in Torrance called them, and later it was what they called themselves. They heard the words yelled after them as they cut over lawns, flashed between cars to the high-pitched skid of slamming brakes, swooped across grocery store parking lots in fast, tight circles for the pleasure of terrorizing the mothers with loaded carts. People simultaneously wanted to kill them, believed they had almost killed them, and were afraid of being killed by them. Albie, a member of the Mataponai tribe. Raul, El Salvadoran, born on this side to parents born on that side. And two black kids, the smaller, handsomer, sleepier-looking one called Lenny, and the other, the tallest of the four, Edison. They had all started riding together when they were 11 and 10, when they were still just irritating boys whose mothers wanted them out of the house in the afternoon. They were dangerous right from the start, forcing the cars they cut in front of to swing hard into people's lawns. One car jumped a curb and went straight into a phone pole while the boys sailed on, whooping the way they imagined the Indians would. The summer they were mostly 12, a car door opened unexpectedly and sent Lenny straight up in the air. The other three slammed on their brakes in time to see their young friend tumble gymnastically across the backdrop of blue sky. It should have killed him, would have killed him had he landed anywhere near his head. But instead, he reached out his right hand to catch himself and snapped his wrist so that the bone came through the skin. Albie crashed not 2 weeks later, a sudden downpour pulling up the oil embedded in the pavement and sending his bike spinning out from under him. Albie broke his shoulder and tore back one ear, which required 37 stitches to reattach. Edison and Raul pedaled carefully around the bike paths in the park for the rest of the summer, scaring no one, not even themselves. Edison came to Albie's house to visit and stood beside the recliner in the darkened living room. Albie had to stay in the recliner pretty much all of the time because of his shoulder.
Everybody has a bad summer sometimes, Edison said,
and Albie, who knew this to be true, gave his friend a Tylenol with codeine while they watched cartoons. By the time they had graduated from Jefferson Middle School, Albie and Lenny and Edison were 14 and Raul was 15. They were tall, but not as tall as they would be. From a distance, it was impossible to tell if the bicycles were ridden by boys or men. They went too fast, and since they were always trying to see which one could outdo the other, the pack of them shifted in furious rotation, like the lead men in a race. The goddamn boys on bikes stole less candy after middle school, concentrating instead on the cans of Ready Whip they slipped into the kangaroo pockets of their sweatshirts when they went to Albertson's. Later, they would ball up together on the floor of Albie's bedroom to take in the small, sweet kick of fluorocarbons or huff airplane glue from paper lunch bags. Each of the four mothers despaired at the bad crowd her son had fallen in with, and, with the exception of Teresa, each of the mothers believed the other boys were entirely to blame. Then, one hot day in the summer they were mostly 14, Raoul's bike slipped its chain. They were miles from home, on a narrow service road that ran beside a field that stretched out wide behind an industrial park. The boys waited while Raoul squatted beside his bike and worked on the chain. The field was unmown and given over to tall grasses and various weeds, all of which had died months before. That was Torrance.
Albie lay on his back on the pavement, which was maybe 2 degrees away from being hotter than he could stand. It felt good on his shoulder. He wished he had sunglasses, but none of them had sunglasses. He took a blue Bic lighter out of the giant buttoned pocket of his long shorts. He had a little pipe in there, too, with a little wooden slide over the tiny mesh basket, but that was just for show. He was long out of pot, and out of the money he had stolen from Holly's babysitting stash to buy more. So instead of getting high, he raised his arm straight up and flicked his lighter at the sun. "What?" Lenny asked. He had tried to sit on the pavement, but it was too hot. He couldn't believe that Albie was lying on it.
"Fire communicates with fire," Albie said, thinking that sounded profound.
Then he turned his head to the right, towards the field, and saw 2 brown moths dipping over the dry grass, and just like that, he brought his arm straight down to the right, the big flame turned to high, and touched the fire to the grass. This was a field made to be burned. The flame licked at Albie's wrist as he snatched his hand away and rolled twice across the pavement before jumping up and grabbing his bike. The fire made a whooshing sound and then an ecstatic crackling, like stiff sheets of cellophane balled up by human hands.
"Fuck, man," Raoul said, stumbling back. "What did you do?"
They were pulling their bikes farther and farther away, swinging a leg over to get out of there. But none of them turned to go. All 4 of the boys were frozen, mesmerized, the weirdest chill washing over their skin while they watched this miraculous growing animal devouring the earth in every direction where there was grass, and not bothering them at all on the pavement. The fire came as high as their waists, their chests, gorgeous beyond anything they'd seen. The rippling orange sheets hanging in the air like a desert mirage, like something that was there and not there. Black smoke curled above the flames, announcing to the neighborhood this very private thing Albie had made.
"Fire! Fire!"
they'd be calling in the industrial park, even though it was already starting to die out at the edges. The fire needed so much. The boys could see it looking for more grass. Anything to keep itself alive. It would have happily burned them up if it meant going for another minute.
"We should get out of here," Edison said, though for all the world it sounded like, "Would you look at that?"
Forget the whippets, the huffing, the pot, forget the bikes even. From that first minute, all they wanted was primordial fire. In the distance, they heard sirens. Yesterday, they would have ridden towards the noise, followed the bright red trucks to the action like a bunch of little groupies after a band. Today, they were the action, and they knew enough to get the hell out of there. It was his grandfather Cousins who had first taught Albie and Cal how to make match guns one summer in Virginia. All the device required was an old-fashioned spring clothespin, a couple of rubber bands, a box of kitchen matches, and a scrap of sandpaper. The boys had been instructed to pay attention to the unspeakably boring old man who had been instructed to impart some piece of family wisdom to the boys. A match gun was what he'd come up with. It meant something different in Virginia, of course, where at least for that one freakish summer of incessant rain, the world had been rendered deep and lush and essentially fireproof. In Virginia, people stored wood in the garage in the hopes that one day it would be dry enough to burn. Having made their guns, their grandfather adjusted a match into position and, zing, sent the missile sailing off the front porch in a pretty arc of flame.
"Never in the barn,"
their grandfather had said to them when he handed over his invention.
"In fact, never by yourselves. Are you listening to me? If you're going to shoot matches, I have to be with you."
Cal was underwhelmed. Whenever he got the chance, he took his father's handgun out of the glove compartment and stuck it in his tube sock under his jeans, tying the butt to his ankle with a tight bandana. He was wearing it that day on the front porch while his grandfather fussed over the clothespin.
But Albie didn't have a gun, so the little flamethrower held his interest. Enough that when he tried to reconstruct one from memory 5 years later in Torrance, he found he could. Spreading out his materials on the dining room table, he made a match gun for each member of his posse. After a single practice session in Edison's backyard, in which they burned up paper towels and Kleenex laid out on the grass at varying distances, they set fire to a mountain of empty cardboard boxes banked behind the liquor store and two dead shrubs in front of an Exxon station. On the days they got up early enough, they shot matches into the newspapers that waited on the sidewalks and front steps of their neighbors' homes. When they were much better at it, they shot those papers while on bikes. They took a city bus all the way to the Sunset Strip and shot matches into the palm trees, standing back to wait for the rats to tumble down the slender trunks as the dried-out fronds burst into flames overhead. They tried to shoot the rats, but that never worked. Rats were fast and not particularly flammable. All through the summer, they set things on fire, despite the drought and the winds, despite the roadside admonishments of Smokey Bear. Fuck Smokey. They weren't interested in anything as sloppy as a forest fire. They liked precision, the art of flame, the single burning newspaper, one abandoned lot. They lit matches through the first 2 months of their freshman year at Shirley High. As shoplifters, they had had a spotty record, but as arsonists, they were remarkably adept at not getting caught. Or they were, until they set their school on fire. Raoul had art last period on Fridays, a peaceful moment at the end of his week in which he was free to draw meticulous dragons breathing fire into trees. Just before he left the classroom, in the second after the bell rang and everyone began to shove their notebooks frantically into their backpacks, he leaned over and flipped the catch on the window sideways to the unlocked position. The art room was in the basement of the school, and the windows were big and at ground level. No one was looking in his direction, and no one saw him do it. He did it only because he could. Miss Del Torre, the art teacher, would turn it back before she went home, or if she didn't think to do it, and Miss Del Torre was an idiot, so who knew, the janitor would do it when he mopped up after school. "I want to go see something," Raoul said to the other boys on Saturday morning. Nothing else going on, and so they didn't even bother to ask him what it was he wanted to see. They just got on their bikes and followed him over to school. He led them behind a low hedge that blocked the window's view to the street, and, looking into the art room, Raoul pushed on the glass, barely tapped on it, and the windows swung open. Albie, elated by the possibility of an interesting Saturday, dragged the four bikes behind the hedge, while Lenny, who was smallest, squeezed through first. Once he was inside and straightened up, he smiled at them through the glass and waved. He found another window at the other end of the room that opened wider, a portal to another world. And one by one, the goddamn boys on bikes